And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Today on the morning show, we are happy to have back in the studios a frequent guest who always provides us with interesting conversation, local author James Niebuhr, who writes on all kinds of different facets of the entertainment industry, and particularly the world of movies. And we've had him on the program on a number of occasions to talk about some of the most important luminaries in cinematic history. And on today's program, we're talking about one of his most recent books, if not his most recent book. And it takes aim at a slightly more recent figure than some of the movie stars that we have talked about, namely the great Clint Eastwood, still very much with us and still a force to be reckoned with artistically. The book at hand is specifically about the many westerns that Clint Eastwood has made throughout his career, beginning with, I think, A Fistful of Dollars and culminating with Unforgiven. And, of course, it's conceivable that there might be other westerns that come from Clint Eastwood, but it's probably not likely as his career winds down and he seems to be exploring other areas. But in the meantime, it's a really interesting aspect of his incredibly successful career. And although at a casual, careless glance, a lot of these movies might seem to be the same movie, just redone over and over again, particularly if all you do is glance at the posters and you just see that kind of iconic figure of Clint Eastwood with the hat on, it sort of looks like it's very much recycled material. And needless to say, that isn't the case at all. That, in fact, each of these films is its own unique experience, its own unique expression. And along the way, as we examine the westerns of Clint Eastwood, we also get a sense of who he was and is, particularly artistically speaking. And he is a formidable figure in more ways than one. Again, this brand new book by James Niebuhr is called The Clint Eastwood Westerns. It's published by Roman and Littlefield. And James Niebuhr, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg.
Good to have you here. Good to have you here. I just wonder with, first of all, how many books do you have to your credit? My word, you are a prolific writer.
Currently working on my 19th.
Hmm. How is it that you decide what is your next project? For instance, I know that something that's being finished now that we'll talk about a few months down the road is a book about Mickey Rooney. Are these entirely out of your own curiosity, or do the folks at Roman and Littlefield have ideas about what you should be writing about? I mean, what sort of guides the choices that you're making?
A few different things. First of all, I have to have an interest in the subject matter, naturally. It has to be something that I care enough about to spend most of the year studying and writing about and examining and exploring and everything else. But it also has to be something that hasn't been done a whole bunch of times. It hasn't been examined too much. Or if it has been, it's been a long time since it's been given that sort of coverage. And now there's some fresh takes that can be made. More has been done. Maybe if you're talking about very early films, more of the movies have been discovered. In the case of the book Terry Lynch and I did on the Buster Keaton, when we were here a couple of years ago together, on Buster Keaton's silent films, there were a couple of Buster Keaton movies that had been discovered that were lost films when other books had been written years earlier. And Terry and I had access to those. And so when we did our book, we could give not only a fresh take on the other films, because Buster Keaton's stature sort of grew afterwards, but also look at films that might not have been covered in previous studies. So there's a situation like that too. But with Clint Eastwood, there was never a film-by-film look at just his Western movies and examining them carefully, because the films that he did with directors like Sergio Leone and Don Siegel and himself pretty much reinvented the Western film, the idea, the concept of the Western.
Something you mentioned in passing, I want to talk about for just a second, because I think it's just important as we kind of think about the career that you've had as a writer and all these different books and the way in which you and other people can examine the full body of work of an iconic figure like Clint Eastwood. At one point, and I can't remember what the film is, it's one of the earlier Westerns. Maybe it's his first one, A Fistful of Dollars, but you mention that the first time it was on network television in the United States was 1975, over a decade after it was made. And it kind of jarred me into remembering that once upon a time, you didn't have Netflix or Blockbuster or whatever, or YouTube. You didn't have easy access to all of these movies that had been made years before. You waited for them to show up on television, and in some cases, you waited in vain. These certain films would never show up on television. And it's just so hard to even remember a world where, in a sense, the body of cinematic history was mostly something you could read about in books. You could not see a film about which you were really curious. I bet you really thank your lucky stars that you're living right now in the time when we can access just about anything that we want to.
Well, when I wrote my first book, I didn't have a VHS machine yet. Those were actually fairly new and not terribly common when I wrote my first book. So I had to wait for movies to come on TV. Fortunately, I had a movie projector where I could get actual 16-millimeter films and screen those. But that was more of an overview of movie comedians. I didn't have to go film by film and study, you know, the films like exactly. It was more like a discussion of like Laurel and Hardy in this chapter, just overall, and then listing other films because you didn't have the internet to go and look up their movies at that time. And then the next chapter might be the Marx Brothers, Buster Keaton, and so forth. And that was my first book. And that's out of print now because it was written years ago. But when I look at it now, it's I wonder why it didn't come with crayons. Because it's, you know, I'll look at it. I guess we are our own worst critic, and I'll look at it and I'll say, I could have said so much more about this or so much more about that. And you can't, like, go back and rewrite something that you did 30 years ago.
Right,
so,
exactly. I think I was recently thinking about this, actually, back in May, which was around the kickoff of this special event in Kenosha surrounding the centennial of Orson Welles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in talking to several different people who had written about Orson Welles, it at some point dawned on me that, you know, way back in, let's say, 1968 or 1970 or 1972, if you've heard of a movie called Citizen Kane, that doesn't mean you ever got to see it. I mean, once in a while it might show up on television, but of course that's also back in the era when we didn't have dozens and dozens of channels. We had three.
Yeah.
And so even a masterpiece like that would be a movie which the vast majority of the American public had never seen.
Yeah, and it had that status as being perhaps the greatest American film, and maybe it certainly is, but if Citizen Kane was running on a local TV station at 12:35 at night, you couldn't DVR it. You couldn't, like, you know, arrange to tape it. You had to stay up and watch it. What I used to do when I was writing my first book is if there was a film I needed to see for the book, and I couldn't tape it. There was no, you know, people didn't have VHS machines as regularly. And so I would set the alarm, get out of bed and watch the movie and take notes, and then go back to bed. And, you know, and I'd have to work the next day. I'd have to go teach in a classroom the next day. And it wasn't exactly easy to do sometimes.
Wow.
But that's just the way we did it, you know, in the snow uphill.
Right. So, yeah. 10 miles a day both
10
ways.
Miles, yeah.
That's right. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with James Nyberg, a good friend of the station and the morning show, who is back today to talk about his most recent book, which is The Clint Eastwood Westerns. Ahead of our conversation about some of the Westerns of Clint Eastwood, we should talk about kind of where he came from and the fact that in some respects, his entry into the world of cinema is kind of a bit of a surprise. You tell us that back in high school, he was a tall, strapping young man, and something about his manner inspired some of the drama teachers at his high school to really try to persuade him to try out for a play or two, something it sounds like he absolutely never did. Mm-hmm. So what got him eventually on the screen?
Well, it was eventually, you know, he kind of found a job, and this was a job, and so he worked that job. It was a fairly inauspicious beginning because he was just a, you know, small-time contract player, and he appeared in a Francis the Talking Mule movie, and he appeared in, I think, one of the Creature of the Black Lagoon movies and so forth. But he was at under contract from Universal for a while, and eventually that dropped, and he found his way onto the TV show Rawhide, and that's what made him pretty famous. That was a popular network TV show, and everybody knew who Clint Eastwood was as a result. Well, the character he played, Rowdy Yates, was, you know, sort of a, you know, good old amiable sort of guy, and he wanted to do something differently. At that point, he started to have some seriousness about acting and realized that he had enough, you know, inherent creativity to contribute more than just the same character week after week. And so when he had a chance to go out to Italy and film some Western called A Fistful of Dollars, where he was playing a completely different character than he was doing television, he took the opportunity. He didn't think the movie was ever going to be seen outside of Italy. He thought it was just some small-time sort of a thing, and he wasn't real familiar with Sergio Leone, the director, but he did his best, and the movie as we see it today really challenged some of the conventions of Western cinema, because the Western is central to the development of movies. Some of the very first narrative films were Westerns. I mean, when you think of The Great Train Robbery from 1903, that's a Western. So that pretty much redefined the conventional Western and redefined how Westerns were made after that. Because, you know, in the wake of that, we had Sam Peckinpah doing The Wild Bunch, and the more conventional stuff, like John Wayne was still making movies and so forth. That was on another plane entirely.
Another planet in some respects. Let's focus on Rawhide for just a moment, because it's probably important to say that Sergio Leone saw Clint Eastwood in an episode of Rawhide, and that's what sparked the invitation anyway. Are you struck by the drastic difference between the character he played on Rawhide and, generally speaking, the characters that he played in film, and especially the characters he played in his Westerns? They would seem to be there seems to be a complete disconnect there.
Yeah, he was a good actor, and he had some versatility. And so when he did his Westerns and he was able to do something very different than the Rowdy Yates character from television, he took that. So rather than play the amiable guy he was on TV, suddenly he's the man. They say the man with no name. He had a character name in all the Sergio Leone Westerns, the Dollars Trilogy. And he was this really, you know, stern, cold, focused sort of guy. And suddenly we're seeing, you know, bloody scenes in Westerns. Suddenly we're seeing guys that got shot in the back and didn't follow this, you know, code of the West that John Wayne, or even at the level of Gene Autry or Roy Rogers or any of those things that had been happening. Because Leone, making films in Italy, they call them spaghetti Westerns. And the perspective is a little stronger, a little more violent, a little more caustic, and some people didn't respond too well to that, because it was like, you know, John Wayne himself didn't particularly like the way, and Clint Eastwood hoped to someday make a movie with John Wayne, but they could never work things out, because John Wayne had his traditional way of looking at how the Westerns were, and Clint Eastwood was making films, especially after the Leone Westerns, when he started his own production company and eventually even started directing himself. You saw what he learned from Leone and from Don Siegel and other directors he had worked with, and the results were often really good and really insightful.
At the time that this film was made in 1964, what was the state of Western cinema? It's, of course, a long history. It dates back to the silent era, and you set some context in terms of all those very popular serials of the, especially the 30s and 40s, I suppose. But what was the sort of the state of affairs by the time this movie was made in the early 60s?
It had been become kind of comfortable, you know, the Western. And even though they were still making Westerns, like I said, John Wayne was still around and so forth, the Westerns at that time had kind of settled into something. I don't know that they were stagnating so much as every once in a while there'd be something challenging. Right around that time, maybe a couple of years earlier, I remember a movie called Lonely Are the Brave, where the cowboy is using his horse and his means to combat people who are after him, like by automobile and so forth. Hmm. And so they were trying to, like, you know, challenge some of the conventions, but essentially Leone just sort of tore the lid off of it and just said, you know, I'm going to make mine more violent. I'm going to make mine, you know, more aggressive. And it was, you know, a fairly inexpensive production. He, you know, had music to punctuate it and sound effects and so forth. And Eastwood, as the central character, who said very little and had an economy of movement, and that stoicism added a certain, you know, fierceness to his character without being blatant, without exhibiting a lot of, you know, blatancy or noise.
We won't have time probably to do this with all of the specific Westerns, but in this case, because it is such an important film, particularly within the scope of his career and also in the way in which it revitalized the whole genre, we should probably give you an opportunity to just say a word about kind of the interesting plot, the basic plot lines of A Fistful of Dollars in terms of this Clint Eastwood character, this drifter, and these two gangs that in a sense he's caught between.
Yeah, he doesn't have an allegiance to either one. He's very much his own man. There's not like, these are the good people, these are the bad people. And at the same time, he's not a good guy. There really isn't a good guy in this movie.
And that would be pretty revolutionary when it comes to Westerns.
Yeah, there's no Western hero. And then
nobody in a white hat. Everybody's got exactly. Either black hats or at best gray.
Yeah. And then after that, when he did For a Few Dollars More, he had that sort of, you know, rivalry buddy sort of thing with Lee Van Cleef, where they were, you know, for each other, against each other. And then The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, where Van Cleef and Eli Wallach was added to the cast. And that sort of culminates the whole, you know, man with no name, as it were, genre, where The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly emerged. It's sort of like a culmination of the three films, and many consider it to be perhaps the greatest Western movie ever made by anybody. Hmm. It's kind of hard to narrow something like that down.
Sure.
But it's certainly one of the greatest.
One of the most interesting points I think you make in this chapter about A Fistful of Dollars, again, the first Clint Eastwood Western movie, you write, as this was a low-budget production, Eastwood's creative input was welcome. And that's a great point, which I don't think would have ever dawned on me, but that would be one of the blessings of making a film like this, a relatively small foreign film, versus if he had signed on to some major studio and made some major blockbuster film, he would not have had that sort of freedom of input. What would be some of the important ways in which, even as someone who'd scarcely ever been in the movies except in the tiniest little parts, what were some ways in which Clint Eastwood was actually able to make a significant contribution to this film aside from his performance?
Well, Eastwood had his own vision. He had an understanding of what this character was supposed to be because this was based on a Japanese film called Yojimbo. Hmm. And Eastwood had screened that film and had an understanding of what Leone was trying to do. And so he pretty much created the visuals for the character. I mean, he created, like, you know, not so much created, but found the costume, made the decision to have, like, the cigarette that he was smoking. He pretty much helped define the character's persona within the context of what the script was offering and what Leone was trying to do as a director. And this creative input allowed Eastwood, who had been very observant on his other films, even the smallest parts, to get a better understanding of sort of the filmmaking process, not just simply showing up and doing your lines and playing the role, but some conceptual is a creative area where when he started directing himself, that was kind of the basis of his better understanding of the filmmaking process.
I'm reminded that you tell us in the time that he was in Rawhide, and despite the fact that he evidently felt some frustration at playing the same character week after week after week, nevertheless, he stuck with it. I mean, he was with that series for its entire run, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah.
But you tell us that fairly early on, he expressed his interest in maybe directing a few episodes, and he was turned down. I think you say that the producers of that series allowed him some freedom to appear in some other series if he so chose. But they weren't about to turn over the director's chair to this very young and inexperienced actor.
Yeah, he was just a guy in his 30s, and he had some ambitions, and they kind of were dismissive about it. It's like, yeah, Rowdy Yates directing an episode of Rawhide, come on. But what's interesting is that one of the guys who directed several episodes of Rawhide, Ted Post, is the guy Eastwood wanted to direct the first Western he made in America, Hang 'Em High, after the Leone Westerns were done and after they were released here and gaining some traction. Eastwood, you know, formed his own production company because he didn't want to do. He did some parts in movies like Where Eagles Dare and so forth, where it was a big production and he was just one of the cogs in the machine. Hmm. And he wanted to have a little more creative control than that. So he started his own production company. And I got a chance to interview Ted Post shortly before he passed away. And he told me all about, and it's in the book, all about what he and Eastwood did together, how Eastwood had some contribution, and how Ted Post's vision as a TV director was expanded for a feature film. And Hang 'Em High, some of the choices they made with the casting, some of the choices they made with how to shoot a fight sequence and so forth, and how Post took what he learned from TV, like, you know, the close-ups that you use more often on TV for the small screen, and he expanded it to the larger screen. There's a lot of things like that in there that are discussed in the book and in that chapter that are very interesting as to how the Western film, after being redefined with the Leone films, started to progress based upon that redefinition.
Hmm. Something else about Mr. Leone I want us to talk about before we move on to later films. My eyes lit up because this is something important to me. You mentioned the fact that Mr. Leone, the director of the first three Clint Eastwood Westerns, was also a huge opera fan.
Yeah.
And it's your contention that that love of opera had some effect on how he directed these films. What do you find operatic in these films?
Well, Ed, as you know, with your knowledge of opera, operas... I don't know if violent is the word, but they are, you know, very, you know, they'll start out nice and gentle and then move up to the big crescendo and kapow and everything else. Well, that's what his Westerns, the Westerns of Leone have that same sort of structure where they can be real quiet and taut and, you know, and then all of a sudden they raise and boom. And then the gunfights are like big close-up of a guy's eyes, and then a close-up of his face, and then a medium shot, then another close-up of his eyes, and it's editing, boom, 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 like that, and gunshots are going off, and bodies are falling, and there's a shot of the gun, and then the exploding, and it's operatic in the sense that it rises with these crescendos every so often.
Interesting. There's a whole genre of Italian opera called verismo, and the term refers to realism. And one of the hallmarks of verismo, besides the fact that somebody usually gets stabbed or strangled or whatever, I mean, they tend to be very violent, but also almost always the backdrop will be very idyllic. So, I mean, one of the most famous verismo operas is about a traveling troupe of clowns. And so against this backdrop of these performing clowns, then is this very, very intense, passionate story that ends with an onstage strangulation and stabbing. And the violent elements have even stronger impact because of that idyllic background. And it sounds like these Westerns sort of create a similar spell. One of the things you also mention in this chapter about Fistful of Dollars is that because it was a limited production, that with a production with a limited budget, it was often low budget shoots, in your words, can be quite grueling. But you say Eastwood's background in the rushed production of weekly series television prepared him for nearly anything that could happen on the set of this movie. I mean, how propitious that. You know, that the one thing which would seem to have very little to do with the other actually really prepared him to flourish under these circumstances. Yeah. And maybe your more typical movie star could not have functioned well in a production like this.
I remember at one time seeing Dick Van Dyke give an interview, because he was very successful in TV, but he also made several movies. And he said, in TV, you're always doing something, but in movies, you work for 20 minutes, then you sit around for 2 hours, then you work for another 20 minutes, and it's kind of a slower process. But with a low-budget film, they had to get things done. They did fewer takes and so forth. And with somebody like Eastwood, he was used to that snapped-up production. What's ironic is the fact that as Leone got more money and got more success, one of the problems Eastwood had with him on The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which is the best film perhaps of the Dollar Trilogy, is that Eastwood didn't like the fact that Sergio Leone was now insisting on many retakes and being very, you know, very careful about what he wanted to do, and, you know, forcing actors to redo scenes in the hot sun. You know, and Eastwood wanted a little more efficiency and proficiency from the director, but now he had gotten to the point. And that's what lost Eastwood the role in Once Upon a Time in the West, which might be Leone's masterpiece, because he wanted Eastwood for the role, but when he went to see Eastwood in America, it took him so long to tell Eastwood about the opening scene and about what he wanted and so forth. And Eastwood's like, you know, get to the point sort of thing. And eventually he, you know, Eastwood didn't want the part. He was doing his own things by then, and Leone didn't give him the part. And then when Leone, years later, made Once Upon a Time in America, he, in press interviews, unfavorably compared that movie's star, Robert De Niro, and compared him to Eastwood, as Eastwood being the lesser of the actors. And they made up before Leone died in 1989. But there was some contention there after a while.
Right. One other little point about this first film, A Fistful of Dollars, because I think it helps underscore what a revolutionary work it was when it came to Westerns. You mention something that, I guess this was the film that didn't make its television debut in America until 1975, so more than a decade after it was made. You tell us that for that network premiere, a prologue was added to this film. A prologue which, in a sense, would have the effect of softening the edges of the story. And that really probably has something that helps us understand how edgy this film was, and then how, in a sense, how spineless American network television executives were, that they felt like they had to add something to this film to sort of turn it into something that it wasn't.
And that was in 1975, after the network had taken some, challenges, had with things like All in the Family and MASH and so forth. That had already happened, and they already got a little edgy by that time. Imagine if they tried to put this on in 1965, just after it was released, when, in between Bewitched and the Beverly Hillbillies, you see A Fistful of Dollars. So
yeah, right. One thing I don't think I quite understand is these three films, which we think of as a trilogy. At one point you say that, for instance, Clint Eastwood's character in For a Few Dollars More is not exactly the same character. So, I mean, I think some people make the mistaken assumption then that these being a trilogy, that somehow he's playing the same character in all of them. And in fact, that's not the case.
It's not so much a trilogy in that sense, but they are three similarly structured Westerns with similar concepts, with the same director and actor, and a few of the same supporting actors. But they are three separate movies that can be, you know, stand up unto themselves. A lot of times, for a few dollars more, gets overlooked because it comes between Fistful of Dollars, the first one, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, often considered the best one, when in fact, for a few dollars more, I think the films probably get progressively better. Fistful of Dollars is an outstanding movie. I think For a Few Dollars More is better. I know that's subjective, but... I think there's a lot to that movie, and it's one of the finest Westerns ever made.
You mentioned something interesting about the third, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, about when an American DVD of the film was made in the early 2000s, and I think this DVD release included scenes that had not ever been included in the American release of the film. Tell us what the folks who put that DVD together did to make those additional scenes made it possible for them to be included on the DVD.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting that they took a scene that was shot, but and they wanted to return it to the movie, but you know Leone was gone by then, and we don't know if he would have approved or not. But I guess they wanted to return it to. The movie, you know, for some manner of authenticity. But the soundtrack was not good enough to use. So they had to get Eli Wallach and Clint Eastwood in the studio to overdub their lines from from that old scene they had shot, you know, almost, you know, what, 40 years later, earlier. And they had to have another actor voice Lee Van Cleef's part because he had died.
Yeah. It's just amazing. I wonder what that felt like for Clint Eastwood to get back in the studio and in a sense reconnect with a film from so much earlier in his career.
Yeah, I put a feeler out to interview Eli Wallach. I got as far as his home number and left a message, but he died maybe only a few weeks later. He was 98 years old by that time. But he had been granting interviews a couple of years earlier, and I figured, you know, if I don't at least try this. I'm going to never forgive myself.
Absolutely.
So,
James Nyber is our guest today on The Morning Show, and we're talking about his most recent book, which is called The Clint Eastwood Westerns. And, of course, I think we've given our listeners some sense of the depth of this book. I mean, you give us so much information about each and every one of these films. And, of course, we'll have to proceed a little more quickly from this point on to at least touch on all the other films that you talk about. Hang 'Em High, which is the next Western by Clint Eastwood, is also the first film which is made with his own production company.
Yeah.
Just say a word about his abilities in this area. I mean, to not only be an effective actor, but also to head up a production company and to take on all the responsibilities that suggests.
There's some level of loyalty there. They hired a lot of people that he had worked with on Rawhide, such as, you know, someone like Bruce Dern and people like that. And he insisted on Ted Post, who the studio has, the producers, were dismissing him as just a TV director. He had done some features, but he was mostly known for television work, and they figured, well, that's a TV director, and we'd rather have you use this guy or that guy. And Eastwood said, no, I want Ted. He's somebody I worked with in the past, and I know how he works, and I think this will be better. And it turned out to be an excellent job by Post. And Eastwood, of course, collaborated a lot with him. What I think is most interesting in that movie, a little offbeat from what we're talking about, is one of the bad guys in the movie is Alan Hale, who is really Alan Hale Jr., but he had played Skipper on Gilligan's Island. And Gilligan's Island had just gone off the air. But as soon as it went off the air, it was put in reruns after school. So not only was it a recent series, but it was still playing in the afternoons when kids got home from school. So Mr. Hale, who had, before Gilligan's Island, made several Westerns in serious roles, was now very much typecast into the role of the befuddled skipper on a silly comedy show, a slapstick comedy series. And very much, you know, can parallel with the Rowdy Yates character and the Leone Westerns. But Alan Hale expressed, Ted Post told me in an interview that Alan Hale expressed some interest in the role. But at the same time, when Post wanted to hire him, he said, look, I don't want to come on screen and then everybody in the movie theaters yell, hey, there's Skipper.
Hey, Skipper.
There's Skipper. And he goes, and that'll wreck the scene for the others, and it'll hurt the picture, and I don't want to be the actor that hurts the picture.
Wow.
And Ted Post assured him it's going to be all right. And when you look at Alan Hale, there's a scene where, well, to set it up, Alan Hale and a group of other guys, you know, ambush the Clint Eastwood character at the very beginning of the movie, and they hang him from a tree. Well, Eastwood is rescued after the men ride off, and they think, you know, they leave him for dead, but he has been rescued. And so as a vigilante, he goes after each one of the people to either lock them up or kill them to get his revenge. Well, there's a scene where Alan Hale, where he walks into town to get the Alan Hale character, and when Alan Hale sees the Clint Eastwood character, he does what can only be described as a double take. And it's not Skipper doing a comical double take, like, you know, he would do if Gilligan did something dumb.
Which is every episode.
Yeah. He uses his knowledge of the double take and does it from dramatic, from a dramatic perspective, where he looks and then looks again and says, whoa, that guy's alive, and he's taken off to jail. He turns his back to us, and that's the last we see of him in the movie. He's been captured, and he's probably going to be tried for the crime that of doing what he did. But the way he used what had been a comic element of his character in the series, and now in his first film after the series, he's using it from dramatic effect. That really impressed me, and I know it's sort of a tangent from what we're talking about.
Yeah,
but within the context of a Clint Eastwood Western directed by a TV director featuring a guy who was popular on TV, as Eastwood had come from television,
right?
It all kind of ties together.
Yeah, some great connections there, and how great that they gave him that opportunity. I suspect, as so often is the case, he was thought to be so typecast that maybe some directors would not have given his that chance. And how generous of Alan Hale to be worried about the film and not wanting to be a distraction. We should mention that when you talk about the film Coogan's Bluff in your book, this would be an example of several films you examine that probably would not be the purest example of a Western.
Yeah.
And yet there are enough elements that you feel like it makes sense to include this. Just remind our listeners of the way in which Coogan's Bluff is not maybe strictly a Western and yet belongs here.
Well, Coogan's Bluff is more modern. It's a modern setting. And the Clint Eastwood character is a lawman from a Western town, and he goes by the old-fashioned Western-type traditions, but he's hired to come and get a criminal and bring him back. He has to go to the big city, and when he's in the big city, he has to respond to big city life, the attitudes. When a woman is, spoken to disparagingly in a sarcastic/humorous fashion by a friend, Eastwood gets ready to attack the guy, thinking, well, hey, you know, you can't do that. And he goes, no, that's the... And also there's a scene where the cab driver gets ready to drop him off, and he sees him as a rube and wants to take advantage, but the Eastwood character notices, hey, you know, he you went past that place twice. So the guy says... That'll be $2.45, including the luggage. And the Eastwood character responds, okay, well, here's $2.50, including the tip. So to show him that you're not pulling it over on me, sort of thing. And he uses his old-fashioned Western type of perspective to enjoy some success in capturing the guy.
Right.
And instead of a horse, he's riding a motorcycle and so forth. So it's just a neat, updating on the old-fashioned Western character and putting it in a different context. And I debated as to whether or not to use that movie in the book, but I thought it had enough of a Western, background to be at least part of, the entire series of Westerns he made.
I think it's really interesting, and I think it's a very good choice. We should mention that although you're obviously a Clint Eastwood fan and that most of these films you hold in very, very high regard, They're not all great movies, and probably the worst of the bunch is the next one, the musical Paint Your Wagon.
You know, there are people who really like that movie, but...
They're few and far between, I would say.
Unfortunately, Clint Eastwood first signed on to it where it looked like it was a darker script and it looked like something different. And somehow, through the many studio heads that prevailed, this wasn't something that he was producing with his own company. This is an example of a big-budget movie that he appeared in, you know, for somebody else. And because it was, you know, has a Western background, even though it's a musical, I did use it in the book. And Eastwood even mentions in an interview that they just had Lee Marvin, who was the star, doing his old Cat Ballou character. And it was really, you know, just sort of a dumb movie that didn't really take very good advantage of any of its performers or, you know, some good songwriters were offering some, you know, songs that were not particularly strong. And you know, it just wasn't, you know, some people like it, and that's all subjective, of course. We could like what we want. But in the context of Clint Eastwood's Westerns, I'm afraid that's a weak sister.
Right. Well, after Two Mules for Sister Sarah, you actually examine a very intriguing film that also is not quite a Western in the purest sense of the word, and yet there are a lot of reasons to spend some time talking about this film called The Beguiled.
Yeah. Well, Clint, Two Mules for Sister Sarah was Eastwood's first time being directed by Don Siegel, who also directed The Beguiled, and who would later that same year direct Dirty Harry, which kind of, you know, pushed Clint Eastwood's career into the stratosphere.
Yeah.
That not being a Western, that's just covered in a bracketing chapter.
Right,
just made
right.
reference to. But The Beguiled was not successful at the box office, and there are people nowadays that say that should have been sold as an art film instead of a Western, because it was sold as a Western, and that's why I use it in my book. He plays a wounded Civil War guy who's taken in by a woman in a, you know, home for girls during the Civil War time, and they kind of take care of him, and you know, things get a little bizarre and crazy, and you know, there's like, you know, romances that are taboo that are going on, and there's betrayals and so forth. And you know, without it, a lot of spoilers, it's one of the few movies in which Eastwood dies at the end. But it's a very, you know, strange, offbeat sort of movie that looks better now than it might have in the context of its time. I talked to one of the leading younger girls in the movie, Pamela Ferdin, who is in this movie. I talked to her, and she said that the reason, she goes, the director was great, Siegel was great, Geraldine Page, and you know, working with Clint Eastwood was great. And she says, but the way, if you look at the movie posters, it looks like, you know, there's a tough Western-looking Clint Eastwood, The Beguiled. And it looks like you're about to see a Western. It's a very different movie. And Clint Eastwood isn't the strong, silent, overcomes-everything type. He's sort of victimized here and ends up, you know, on the losing end at the conclusion. And Pamela said, you know, I don't think people were ready for that.
Right.
Now, because I hear a lot of people telling me that's, you know, one of the best movies I've ever been in, and I agree with them. But at the time, she said that that was something that people just didn't want. So not a success in its time, but it lived on with greater respect.
Right. We're just about out of time. We want to mention that the first time Clint Eastwood directs himself in a Western is High Plains Drifter, which is a powerful, intriguing film. And, of course, as you've already touched on, he scores even bigger success with the Dirty Harry movies, The Enforcer, and so on. Clint Eastwood intermittently returns to the genre of the Western with Bronco Billy and Pale Rider and other films, and then the film we should take a couple of minutes to talk about, of course, is this intriguing work from 1992 called Unforgiven. At some point in that chapter, you say something to the effect that this is, in a sense, a perfect culmination of Clint Eastwood's career in Westerns. What came together in Unforgiven?
Well, the first Western he directed, High Plains Drifter, showed what he had learned from Siegel and from Leonio, the shots, the use of violence, the structure. And then after that, he did The Outlaw Josie Wales, which is an enormously brilliant Western film, followed by Pale Rider, which takes Shane, the concept of the movie Shane, which is quite conventional, and reinvents it from Eastwood's vision. These are all films that Eastwood was now directing himself. And then finally, Unforgiven in 1992, which is his last Western, it culminates because the central character that he plays is almost a composite of all the other ones, from A Fistful of Dollars to the present, in his various Westerns, where he has all of the different idiosyncrasies that those characters had. He has just about all of their histories wrapped up in this William Money character that he plays. And he's somebody that was so violent, so vile, so bad, that he just finally, gets some sort of epiphany, leaves it all behind, goes and lives off by himself, raising a couple of kids. But the time comes where what he used to do is needed again, and he has to reach down and draw from that. And, they filled out the cast with people like Morgan Freeman and, Gene Hackman and people like that. It's such of a strong cast, and Eastwood's direction is has now been honed to perfection by this time. And it just ties everything together so perfectly that if somebody said that The Unforgiven is the greatest Western in which Clint Eastwood appears, there would be some argument supporting that.
Well, it's a great way to also finish out this book, in which you take us on such a perceptive, thorough journey through these various films, and it really kind of helps us follow the trajectory of this career. And we should also remind people that you don't ignore the non-Westerns along the way, that there are these chapters that also offer interesting perspective on the non-Westerns, which are also an important part of Clint Eastwood's legacy. The book, again, is called The Clint Eastwood Westerns, published by Roman and Littlefield, and the author, James Niebuhr. James Niebuhr, what a great pleasure to be speaking with you again today, and we look forward, when the Mickey Rooney book is finished and published, to having you back to talk about that and all the other books that we know are going to emerge from your prolific pen over the coming years.
I have a true crime book coming out
that's
a total departure for me, because it's about actual kidnapping and murder that occurred in the 1920s. That'll be coming out towards the end of this year, or maybe the beginning of next year, and so we can talk about that when that's published, too.
Absolutely.
So it's
look forward to
completely different than what I've been doing.
Wonderful. James Niebuhr, thank you for joining us today on The Morning Show.
Thanks,
was fun.
I hope I made sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It was great. Great. Happy to have you here. Jonathan Shaler from the UW Parkside faculty will join us tomorrow as we shift from Clint Eastwood to Shakespeare. That'll be on tomorrow's Morning Show. Sunny and pleasant conditions ahead, a high of 79 degrees today, a high over low overnight of 58.